Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Thank you. Yes, we did.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Candidate Confessional. I'm Sam Stein, and the audio you're hearing here is from December of 2010, when President Barack Obama signed a bill striking down the 16-year-old policy barring gays from serving openly in the U.S. military.
So this morning, I am proud to sign a law that will bring an end to Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell. In 1994, the Clinton administration had adopted a policy which, at the time, was seen as a compromise between gay rights and a conservative military establishment.
Under the plan, new recruits would not be asked their sexual orientation, but soldiers and sailors would still not be allowed to openly declare their homosexuality.
It is the best way to proceed because it provides a sensible balance between the rights of the individual and the needs of our military to remain the world's number one fighting force.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell allowed gays to serve, but they did so under the constant threat that if their sexuality was discovered, they could be discharged. As the years rolled by, the gay rights movement gained more ground. Don't Ask, Don't Tell increasingly started to look like an anachronism. But it proved stubbornly difficult to dislodge, that is, until 2010.
I want to thank the Democrats and Republicans who put conviction ahead of politics to get this done together.
At that ceremony, the president specifically thanked a number of lawmakers who had made special contributions in the fight to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And he made sure to single out one congressman seated in the front row.
A guy you might know, Barney Frank.
For nearly 30 years, Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank had been the most visible and vocal openly gay politician in the country.
Gay men and lesbians will no longer submit to unequal treatment.
The fight to allow gays to serve openly in the military had been central to his career. He was in Washington when Don't Ask, Don't Tell became official military policy.
By not allowing officially and legally a zone of privacy when you're not regularly in the company of your fellow soldiers, it's putting too much of the onus on the gay and lesbian service members themselves. And I can't accept that.
And he was there 16 years later when it was finally repealed.
Let's not have any libel of the honorable gay and lesbian and bisexual people who want to serve their country and are being rebuffed by people on the other side.
Today on the show, I sit down with Barney and I hear the whole story from his point of view. Welcome to Candidate Confessional. Now, before we get to Barney, let's just set the scene here, because where the story really starts is in the midst of the 1992 presidential campaign.
For the first time in a race for the White House, gay and lesbian issues were an important part of the campaign.
That year, Bill Clinton became the first major party nominee to really make gay rights an issue. And what's more, he explicitly promised to do away with the ban on gays in the military.
Every day that we discriminate, that we hate, that we refuse to avail ourselves of the potential of any group of Americans, we are all less than we ought to be.
And so, in the gay community, Clinton's election was greeted with jubilation.
We're here! We're clear! We're going to the White House!
But the issue was far from fait accompli. Clinton's biggest obstacle was a highly skeptical military establishment, personified by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, one Colin Powell.
I've got to consider what you say to a youngster who might come and say, Sergeant General, in the most private of my accommodations, I prefer to have heterosexuals around me and not homosexuals or gays.
Powell's concern, and the concern of most generals, was that introducing the element of open homosexuality into the military environment could hurt unit cohesion.
We are trying to build the greatest level of coherence and cohesion in a unit where people depend on each other totally for their life in close combat situations. That is not a place, in my judgment, to introduce sexual differences.
The problem is that it would cause problems with the others. It was the kind of what we call in civil liberties talk the heckler's veto, the notion that you can't make a speech because other people are then going to misbehave. So what Powell basically said was, oh, no, you people would be fine, but it is the prejudice that other people have towards you that makes this an unsettling fact.
This is the foundation for the morale argument, essentially,
yeah.
which basically says, you know, you will hurt the morale of the heterosexual soldiers because they'll be looking over their shoulder,
yeah,
uncomfortable in the bathroom.
The best answer to that comes from my husband, Jim. I didn't know him at the time, but he was in on the successful conclusion to this fight in 2010. And he said, let me see if I understand this. You are in the military. You're out there in battle, and you are there when your best friend is shot to death, and you see your friends bleeding and torn and battered, and you're expected to be able to live with that. But the notion of a naked man in the shower next to you who might find you attractive, you can't handle that. It did not say much for the—
But this morale argument sort of held until, you know, much later in time.
Right, and the reason is this— it was partly believed. It was more that things had changed. When the bans on gay people first came up in America, people didn't feel that they had to hide this. I bet even the 70s, hey, I don't, what are you telling me? I got to be nice to a fag? No, they're bad people.
Yeah.
By the late 80s and 90s, it was no longer, if you weren't an outright bigot like Jesse Helms or Antonin Scalia, who succeeded Helms as the bigot in chief in America, it wasn't proper. It wasn't respectable to say you didn't like us. So they had to come up with reasons why you could have these policies. For example, the reason we couldn't get married was that if we got married, it would destabilize straight marriage.
Yeah.
A nonsensical argument. But they didn't want to come right out and say what really motivated a lot of these people. You know what? We don't like one of them, so two of them hanging out is even worse.
Well, in each case, it's the premise is that we heterosexuals are too weak-minded, too
yes,
weak-willed. We can't handle
it. That's
this.
What I said. As Jim said to my husband, that you can put up with
death and
being
blood
shot
and
at
shrunk.
and carrying your bloodied comrade, but you couldn't stay.
So I read this. I had not remembered this at all, but in preparation for this, in October 1992, a man named Alan Schindler, a gay naval officer, is murdered. Do you remember this? Did that name?
Sure.
Can you tell me what happened?
He was on ship, and apparently they knew he was gay. And on shore leave, he was cornered in a urinal by a much bigger comrade, I think, with somebody else. And they beat him to death. They just bludgeoned him to death.
And it was clear that it was because of his homosexuality.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
In what ways did this reverberate politically?
Well, it's interesting. On the one hand, of course, it might have been rationale. Ammunition for that rationale. See what happens. A man is gay and it makes these people crazy. But on the other hand, it undermined that argument because the Powell argument basically blamed the victim. Oh, you guys are good. You know, by now, after Powell and Cheney together, we're not a security risk. We're perfectly good soldiers, but we're not allowed to do this because other people will misbehave. But when the other people misbehave by beating somebody to death, that kind of undercuts that. People don't want to be associated with the notion that it's okay to beat someone to death, that that's a
yeah,
good reason to that the way you protect people from being beaten to death is to deprive them of their rights.
Yeah. And
so that just reverberated. In some ways, it was people will remember the much more publicized but more recent Matthew Shepard
murder.
But the Schindler murder, particularly among the gay community, had the same impact as the Matthew Shepard murder.
Now, Clinton, in this milieu, Clinton comes, Arkansas governor, you know, not exactly known as, he's not a liberal. He's sort of a centrist Democrat, but he decides he's very progressive on gay issues, probably the most progressive, definitely most progressive Democratic candidate at that point in time. And he decides that he's going to call for an end
Not on his own. There was a member of Congress who was very close to Clinton, Tom Downey, liberal from Long Island, who I was very close to. We worked together on a lot of things. And he felt, you said, Clinton was seen as a centrist, and Downey's argument was, no, look, he's probably the most liberal guy we can get elected.
Yeah.
This is, you know, after Mario Cuomo says he's not running and other people in 92 bow out, and Clinton really then seems to be the most electable liberal, or the most liberal of the electables. Downey has a meeting in his office in the Capitol complex in the House office building of about five or six of us with Clinton, in which Clinton can make his pitch to liberals. And at that point, I asked him about the ban on gays in the military. I think that is the first time he addressed it and said, here's where we are. And I said, you know, Cheney says this and Powell says that. We're not bad soldiers. We're not security risks. The only problem is other people don't like us. And he said, yeah, I agree with that. And I said, you know, it's an executive order. You get rid of it. So it was at that point that he said, yeah, he would be he would, if he was president, abolish it.
You represent a community of our nation's gifted people whom we have been willing to squander. We can't afford to waste the capacities, the contributions, the hearts, the souls, and the minds of the gay and lesbian Americans either.
And I don't think people who are listening to this will understand just how big a decision move that was in the context.
It was enormous. We got lulled a little bit because he said that, and he repeated it a couple of times during the campaign.
So Clinton wins, but before he takes office, I think this is sort of a critical moment that's kind of lost in history, is a judge rules that the existing policy is unconstitutional. This now forces Clinton's hand in a way that he probably had not been anticipating.
I'm glad you said this, and that's so unfair to Clinton. What happens then is that in the fall, during the campaign, a gay sailor named Keith Meinhold.
Keith Meinhold is one of more than 1,000 servicemen and women kicked out of the armed forces each year for homosexuality.
He sues on the grounds that it's unconstitutional.
He files suit, won, but the Navy refused to reinstate him until the federal court threatened a contempt charge.
What his argument is that, what, is it the same argument that upheld gay marriage, that it's a right to serve or something like that?
It's, yeah, well, it's discriminatory. I would guess, I don't remember the thing, the basic argument in that case is you're being denied equal protection of the
Equal protection, okay. Yeah.
So now what happens is he decides that. Clinton is now president-elect, and the decision to appeal or not to appeal is going to come within the first few weeks of his presidency because there was a deadline. And people have unfairly said, well, why did you guys make that the first issue of the presidency? And the answer was, we didn't. We didn't want it to be. We just – but he had no choice.
Had this judge not had this decision and forcing Clinton's hand, was it your contention that Clinton would have waited?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
He wanted to start with health care. He wanted to start with family and medical leave and some other things.
Yeah. Which did come up first in the House, but then this all gets very complicated.
No, it came up in the Senate, and that's why.
And that's the vehicle, yeah. Okay, but before we get there, you had an incident where you relayed a conversation about gays in the military that you had with Clinton to David Broder.
I told Broder, I saw Broder in the immediate post, you know, just a
this is
day
the
or
famed
two.
Washington Post, probably the biggest political reporter of his day.
Yeah, and a couple of days before, but again, I underestimated the kickback. We were talking, and now by this time, the decision had been made, so he was going to have to decide it. And I reaffirmed that with Clinton, and I said to Broder, "Yeah, well, he's going to go forward and get rid of it." So Broder, that's when I realized this was a bigger story than I had thought. And so
you had gone an entire campaign where no one noticed this. Then Broder picks it up and suddenly
it becomes a big
boom.
Story. But it's magnified by the fact that Colin Powell, the African-American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, comes out strongly in favor of maintaining the policy. And at that point, when people say, well, isn't this like the segregation? He says, oh, no, race is a benign condition.
I think the issues are quite different. 40-odd years ago, we already had blacks openly in the military and had them for 100 years. It was a question of equal opportunity once they're in the military. And we were talking about something that was a fairly benign characteristic with respect to skin color. With respect to gays in the military, it is, for us, a far more complicated issue.
He said, well, being black was a benign condition. Race was a benign condition. He meant,
does
I'm pretty sure,
being
benign.
Gay is malignant?
Well, that's exactly the problem. He meant, I'm sure, benign as opposed to active. That race was something.
Oh, you can choose or something
stupidity,
like that.
Stupidity, but not. But,
which was an, which was a thinking. It's antiquated, obviously, but it was what people thought back
but,
then.
But obviously, the obvious antipode to benign is malignant, as you say. And then within the Democratic Party, Sam Nunn, who was a committed bigot.
Georgia Democrat.
Career. Yeah. But what happens is Powell comes out against it and Nunn come out against it. And all of a sudden, it's a huge issue. So we're now into January. Clinton is president. And through no fault of his or mine, this becomes one of the first items on the legislative
agenda.
So
now people are probably saying, well, okay, Clinton, why not just, you know, get rid of it by issuing some sort of executive order saying, I'm the commander-in-chief. This is
how the – Here's the reason. One of Clinton's important campaign promises was to women's groups – and particularly women in organized labor, to sign the bill that gave family and medical leave as a matter of right.
Yeah.
That's now – that's one of those things that the private sector, the right wing said was going to destroy business in America.
It's been a transcendent piece of legislation.
Yeah, and it's been in – and it says that you can take leave for having children, maternity or paternity, et cetera. It was a very important piece of legislation. It passes the House and it comes up in the Senate. Now, the Senate has no rule that says amendments have to be germane to the legislation.
Okay.
The House does. In the Senate at this point when this comes up, Bob Dole sees an opportunity, and he played a very bigoted role in all this. Bob Dole sees an opportunity with Sam Nunn's support. While it is true Clinton, as president, had the power simply to abolish the order, it was a policy that Congress could have reinstated by statute. Now you could say, well, why wouldn't Clinton veto it? But here's the problem. The Republicans then announce that they will offer a reinstatement of the ban or a statutorization of the ban, if it hasn't yet been abolished, to the Family Medical Leave Act.
So then he's forced to veto.
Pass. So the choice then would be either you accept writing into permanent law the ban or you disappoint this big promise. That's what broke our back. So they agree to withhold the amendment to the Family and Medical Leave Act in return for Clinton holding off
on an executive,
executive order. So the Family and Medical Leave Act becomes law. And then you have this situation where he's agreed.
And now this is a full-on like mega media story.
Absolutely. It's a big – one of the biggest stories in the country. And as I said, now people also said, but why didn't he just order Colin Powell to go along? Well, Colin Powell was in his last few months as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What was going to do, fire him? And by the way, how would it have helped our cause? I've asked my gay and lesbian friends, if in defense of our equality, Clinton fires the leading African-American. I mean, one of the great strengths we've had on the LGBT issues is the strong support we've gotten from the Congressional Black Caucus and others.
Sure.
That would have dinged it a little bit if it had been the and the Powell thing. So that's the story. That's what happened.
Now, how much time had Clinton bought himself for a compromise?
6 months.
6 months.
So
let's talk about the activism that starts erupting, because on the one hand, you have LGBT or I guess gay rights groups at the time, and they're sort of nascent. It's not what it's not the political force that you see today, but they're there. You have some predominantly Northeast liberal Democrats. And then on the other hand, you have what is a wave of very impassioned phone calls flooding Congress saying,
this is the first time I came to some serious separation on strategy and tactics from my friends in the LGBT movement. It was mostly the transgender issue had not surfaced as much yet. The problem was, and it was a pattern to be repeated over many years, our opponents lobbied Congress, and my allies had rallies. I remember at one point Dick Durbin, who was a strong early supporter, Senator Durbin, of our equality, saying to me, hey, Barney, where are your people? Our offices are getting flooded. The offices were getting flooded with antis. The Democrat, the pro-gay groups were having rallies. They formed the campaign for military service, and I had strong arguments with them. And I could not believe it. And I said, well, you got to get out there. One of the things that hit me was, no, look, part of the problem was the strategists who surfaced in the movement were people whose expertise was in political campaigns. And what they said was, all right, here's the deal. We don't want to go out too early with our efforts to persuade. We have – because –
Why?
Well, in a political campaign, they said, you know, people can change their minds, so we're going to hold it to the end. I said, yeah, but here's what they didn't understand. The audience here was not the average voter. It was the members of Congress. Members of Congress were making commitments. Once a member of Congress has made a public commitment, she can't change her mind the way a voter can 3 days before the election. In fact, at one point, Ron Dellums, one of the great civil libertarian defenders of people's rights in the history of the American Congress, an articulate African-American who'd been a Marine, is now chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the House. Nunn is the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he's using his committee to propagandize against us. He goes into submarines and asks people, what do you think? I mean, he had many more hearings about us than NATO. Ron Dellums wants to have a hearing, and outrageously, one of the worst things I ever did, the people running said, you got to ask Ron not to have the hearing. I said, I think it makes sense. No, it's very important. The whole community agrees. So I said, Ron, they'd like you not to have the hearing. He was heartbroken. I was ashamed of myself for asking. It was really stupid, this articulate.
Why did you – what was the rationale for not
I don't know. I never could find out. They were holding their fire. I mean, it was this terrible mistake that they were going to make. They had this powerful campaign that was coming. It was just stupidity. I can't. But then we have rallies. That was the year, 1993, that there was a big – gay march on Washington. There'd been one in 79. This is the biggest one. So they have the march, and Tim McFeely, who was the head of the Human Rights Campaign, one of the important organizations at the time, has written about this. They couldn't get people to lobby the members of Congress. So people came to Washington, had a big parade, had a big
rally.
They're
in Washington, marching in Washington.
And don't go to the members of Congress. And one of the worst things was we have a and it's a self-indulgence. There was a one of the speakers at the march, a very prominent female show business personality, who says, and this is being covered on C-SPAN, isn't it great that we finally have a first lady I'd like to fuck? This is supposed to be helping us.
Damn.
And people have tried to compare what we've done to the civil rights movement. Unfortunately, they did it better. I've said, you know what? If in 1964, at the March on Washington, or 63, Red Fox had gotten up and talked about wanting to have sex with Jackie Kennedy, they would have thrown him in the reflecting pool head first. I mean, it was stupidity. And then at one point, and this something, but he wrote a book criticizing me about it, they had eight of the guys who had been fired for being honest about themselves, very courageous people, and they were lined up ready to go on stage behind the stage. And some idiot decided that it would be great to have them do a kick line.
On stage.
Yeah, like the Rockettes. No, just out,
okay,
off stage.
Okay, okay.
And I saw them starting doing it. I ran over and said, God, stomp this. I mean, that's all we needed was for that to be on television. And, look how stuck – look how stiff he is. Look how, you know, he's an assimilationist. But the problem was we did – I could not get our side to do any lobbying.
Were you accused of being – like an assimilation. I don't want to say Uncle Tom because that's the wrong.
No, still, but not being militant enough.
Yeah.
And I said, well, no, militance has to do with your goals. Being sensible. I most recently, I'm very proud to say that Kathy Griffin, who I had not met before, but has political judgment as bad as any human being I've ever seen. They brought her, for some reason, they brought her down towards the end in 2010 when we finally were able to win this.
Sure.
And she came down and just was talking stupid. And I tried to calm her down at one point, and okay. She later said that she didn't think I was really gay because did not have the spirit. But that,
the spirit. I want to talk about the – you used the word propagandize. And I was rereading some of the clips about these hearings.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's weird to see this language in print because now it sounds like screeching.
It's even weirder to live through it.
I'm sure. And I want to get – that's what I want to ask you about. I mean, some of these quotes from the hearings, Commander saying homosexuals are notoriously promiscuous. These are congressional hearings. People would feel uncomfortable feeling of someone watching you in the shower. This was military personnel explaining why they felt it was impossible to have gays openly serve in the military. And as a openly gay man – you know, it's beyond political at that point. It is emotional. It's personal. It hurts, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. No, and I would – that's when I began – when I would say before, you know, the rule in Congress is you don't take things personally. But I would say this is personal. In fact, I was able to kind of make fun of it. It was so ridiculous. The point man that Bob Dole appointed, the Republican point man – this is back when they were going to put the amendment on. And the guy who became the point man – is now – what is he the head of – not the CIA. It's a Senate, former Senator Dan Coats from Indiana.
He's in a he's natural, DNI.
Yeah, Director of Natural National Intelligence. He and I debated at one point on TV, and he said, well, you know, you can't expect straight men to want to take showers with gay men. I said, Dan – he was – he'd been in the House. I said, Dan, you and I have been together in the showers in the House gym. I mean, I'm a gay man, and I quoted Alfred Hitchcock. Alfred Hitchcock once said this, you know, people complained that they had shower phobias after Psycho.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm gonna borrow this from Alfred Hitchcock. You know, we gay men, we are in gyms, we are in locker rooms all over the place, and we get sweaty, and we do not have ourselves dry cleaned. we showered. You've showered with me. Frankly, it wasn't that big a deal to me. I don't know about to you. But that was the argument that
But it wasn't – I just couldn't get over reading this stuff. And
Sam Nunn going and, you know –
Yeah, of course. But by the way, what it was like back then. I mean, it was bigoted. It was openly bigoted you would never conceive of today.
And the problem was that, when – one of the prominent speakers at the gay march talked about how she'd like to have sex with Hillary Clinton. That does not – that reinforces the promiscuity. Yep. They care about sex over everything. So – but what then happens is that Clinton, in good faith, does try to negotiate a deal.
Yes. Let's go to that. So how – what is the negotiation?
Les Aspin, who was a very supportive guy who'd been secretary – was appointed secretary of defense, is put in charge of negotiating. He was trying – and I – at that point, by the way, I proposed compromise. People got angry at me. Let's have a situation where when you're on duty, in uniform, on base, you don't discuss your sexuality. But you cannot get in trouble if when you're off the base, when you're off duty, whatever, you're going to a gay club, if you live with somebody at home, that's okay.
On your own time, do your own
thing. Yeah. And
that would have violated the morale doctrine that Powell had put out there.
It would have vitiated it. We won't tell you, but don't – you know. But
both you might know me in personal life that I'm gay.
But I'm this is – it would not have been perfect, but it would have been – frankly, what a lot of gay people do it anyway, which is – at any rate, the – so – but if they found out, it was not a cause for dismissal.
Okay.
It was not a cause for discipline. Aspin tried to sell that, and what his report to me was, at that point, Powell said – he would accept that. Powell says to Aspin, according to Aspin, I'll support that, but I need to have at least one of the other chiefs. Remember, there's a chief for each of the service. Sure. There's Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marines. They get a separate one, and the chairman. And none of the other chiefs would go along. In fact, the head of the Marines at the time, I forget, he was particularly vicious and bigoted. I forget his name. So they couldn't get that. The best they could get was this don't ask, don't tell, which was...
You know how that concept came about? There's some emails released by the Clinton Foundation recently that suggest that it was Powell himself who, in written notes, they had him... He scribbled, stop asking. And that was sort of the intellectual foundation of don't ask.
You know, that... I never liked that. I helped lead a fight against it. It would have been an improvement over the status quo, except that even that... Once it went in place, the military didn't abide by it because they did ask and they did stoop. And my criticism of Clinton, I hope this has become clear. Clinton was very courageous and it was not – he was ready to be with us. He was forced to back down only because they were going to kill the family and medical leave bill. But one, he was so traumatized by it that once it became the don't ask, don't tell policy, the military then did not give even that minimal benefit and they misused it.
Well, let's describe what the actual compromise was. So they hash out a deal and under it, you cannot be openly gay. What else? You
cannot be asked if you're gay.
You cannot be asked if you're gay.
And you cannot do anything that manifests your being gay.
Sure. And you can be expelled from the military if you show a propensity or intent to do a homosexual act.
So if they, if you announced you're living with someone or whatever, if you have a picture of your spouse, the problem was that they went beyond that and they asked and they accepted anonymous reporting and they, monitored activity. So theoretically, it was if you are living very discreetly, if they find out, I mean, the spirit of it would have been if somehow people find out that you're gay, despite your efforts to keep it quiet, you're not penalized.
Correct. And you could declare that you are gay, or you could be found out that you're gay, but you could show that you were strictly going to follow the code of conduct in that case, and you would not necessarily be expelled.
And they flouted that. They just absolutely flouted that.
So did anyone like the compromise?
No. I think when it went and so then when it went to
wait, I got to read this. This is where I want to read the New York Times piece. So this is how the New York Times wrote about it in their piece. And the piece is dated July 20th, 1993. The headline is "Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue." So it was "Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue." I didn't realize it was known as that first. "Is White House's compromise solution new U.S. military policy tolerates homosexuals?" The last graph of this piece says, "Under the new policy, the ban against homosexual conduct remains. A person can be a homosexual as long as he or she does not act like a homosexual or tell too many people. Recruits would not be asked if they are homosexuals, nor would anyone on active duty be officially asked. If asked, no answer would be required." I could not get over the line that as long as he or she does not act like a homosexual.
And by the way, the problem was that they did not – as bad as that was, they didn't live up to it because they did pursue.
Yeah.
They did investigate. They did accept. So it became – it was almost a trap for some people. And
so no one liked the compromise.
No. And in fact, when it came out – and my criticism of Clinton at the time again was – and he's been largely unfairly criticized over this. He really did do his best and he lost through no fault of his – but once it was there, he tried to make it seem like sort of a win, which it wasn't, and then allowed the military to abuse the spirit, and they did pursue, and they didn't give even that little morsel of support. If you were particularly tough, you could deal with it. I had a police officer from a town in the district I represented, who Steve Morin, who was a gay man. He'd been an MP. And then he was in Iraq in the military police. He was a police officer, and he then came back. He was gay, and he was my driver. In his off duty time, I paid him as my driver, and he was called into his reserve unit, and the commanding officer, the woman, reported that he'd been seen in a gay bar in Providence, Rhode Island. He lived near there, and he said, "Ma'am, are you asking me if I'm gay?" She said, "No." He said, "Okay, am I dismissed? Can I leave?" I mean, he knew his rights. And
yeah.
But in other cases, they kind of coerced people into doing it. So, no, I thought it was a terrible idea. And, in fact, Gary Sons and I then together offered an amendment on the floor of the House. The bill came forward. Then they made it statutory because they didn't trust him not to amend it. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell became statutory that year. We offered an amendment in the House. There were two amendments in the House, one from the right, which said no, flat-out ban, and then one from the left, our side, which said no, flat-out repeal of the ban. And I remember being asked by the Democratic leadership, please don't make people vote on this. A lot of Democrats don't want to. And, yeah, I would say, look, I'm not going to gratuitously put my colleagues at risk if there's no gain. But I said to him again, this is personal. I can't not do this. I can't sit by.
What was the vote?
We got a majority of the Democrats. But we lost, I think we got almost no Republicans. And I forget it was almost 2-1 for the main against our amendment. And then in the Senate, Senator Boxer, that's where she came in. That was her first year in the Senate. She came in 92. She offered the amendment. So we offered those amendments and we lost. But there is a next step to the story.
After the break, the next step.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, welcome back. When we left off, Don't Ask, Don't Tell had become official military policy, and the gay rights movement was left pondering what its next move would be. Now, there was a general assumption still that this policy couldn't last, that the momentum was on their side, but few would have guessed just how long it would take to repeal.
At the time that this happens, what's your realistic assumption about how long it will take for this policy to be wiped off the books and actually allow gays to serve openly in the military?
I think we're making real progress, but here's the deal, and this turns about to be the case. I also knew then, and this is still the case, no legislation that is supportive of equal treatment for people based on sexual orientation or now gender identity wins unless you have a Democratic Senate, House, and President.
You have to have the trifecta.
So I began – I thought after a few years, we can probably do this the next time we have a Democratic Senate, House, and President. And, in fact, that was the case.
Yeah.
Because in 2010, the end of that
– you just never thought it would take till 2010.
To have a Democratic President, House, and Senate. I didn't foresee that we were going to lose in 94. Because remember, at that point, the House in particular and mostly the Senate went Republican for 12 years. But the next time we got a Democratic President, House, and Senate, we were able to do it. It took to the last minute. But there's one other thing in fairness to Clinton. He was unhappy at the failure, partly because he wasn't supportive of our equality, and he felt some political sting. And I then volunteered that I talked to him and said, okay, we lost on this, and I don't blame you for losing. And as I said, it was the votes were there to stop it. But there are some things you can do on your own without Congress that will help LGBT equality. And he agreed to do all three, and they have been very important. One was to say for the first time, Janet Reno had the legal authority to do it and did it, that if you were being persecuted in your home country because you were gay or transgender, you could get asylum.
Yeah.
And that's been used for, I don't know, a lot of people since then. Secondly, they did send out a letter from the Office of Personnel Management saying, please be clear that people being gay or lesbian cannot be taken into account in promotions or hiring. But most importantly, Clinton, on his own, as an executive order, repealed the Eisenhower executive order that said we couldn't get a security clearance. And that was 41 years later. And by the way, we had gone through John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Jimmy Carter, none of whom had done that. And that underestimated, and Clinton deserves enormous credit for that. In fact, people don't realize security clearances apply to millions of people, not just everybody in the military who works for the State Department, who works for the Department of Energy, et cetera. But if you're a private citizen working for a company that has a contract with any of those, a law firm, an accounting firm, an architectural firm, construction firm. And during my years when I was one of the kind of the ombudsman for gay and lesbian people in, at the federal level, the single most common problem brought to me was I work for this or that company. We just got a contract and the FBI is now investigating to see if I'm gay. And in fact, there was one of the founders of the gay rights movement, a great man named Frank Kameny, since died, who was a crusader. He set himself up as a non-lawyer, as an expert in defending gay people and security clearance
really?
Situations. And he was good at sort of forcing
micro practice there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when we passed the bill,
he was put out of business.
Yeah. When
poor
Clinton,
guy.
When Clinton signed the executive order, he said, "Well, he had mixed feelings because we put it." So to give Clinton his Clinton deserves credit.
I think it's not a controversial thing. He has a mixed reputation on the issue of gay rights,
and it's unfair.
You think it's unfair?
Totally unfair. Okay. He did everything he could within his power, including trying to get rid of this, appointing people for the first time to confirmable posts, and doing but now what was interesting is – and people ask, well, wait a minute.
Look at the Defense of Marriage Act. I mean that's like the big federal marriage amendment stuff that came later in his term.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what the big knock on Clinton is.
Well, yeah. Well, what happened was in 96, that was again Bob Dole. Clinton's running against Dole, and they put that on his desk, and
he just felt electorally.
But before that, when he got rid of the security clearance ban, theoretically they could have done the same thing on security clearances they did with gays in the military. That is, they could have
put legislation on. Yeah.
The problem was they didn't have, and you correctly focused on, they didn't have the morale argument, because people at the Department of Commerce don't shower together. I mean, civilian employees. Yeah, well, it's voluntary. So they could not make that argument.
Yeah.
That didn't stop them. There's a right-wing former congressman named Bob Dornan, who people may not remember him, but they will remember his uncle, who played the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. Actually, it was a great Hollywood fight. He ran against Gregory Peck's son in a classic Los Angeles congressional race in the 70s. Dornan was a super homophobe who ultimately was defeated. He claimed it was a kind of a lesbian conspiracy when he lost to Loretta Sanchez. And in fact, he tried to prove it by showing that a large number of women had voted in his election from the same address. This is a true story. And he said, how could 32 women all be living in the same place? It was a convent. literally. But he announced that he was then going to file a bill because
on the security clearance stuff.
This is 95, so it's only a couple years later. And I, at that point, said, and I'm proud of this, I said publicly, all right, here is the deal. I obviously don't think that it's a security risk to be gay. I don't think I'm a security risk. If, on the other hand, it was to become the law of America that if you are gay, you are a security risk voted in by this Republican Congress, I would consider it my duty to report to the appropriate authorities all the gay members of Congress that I know and their staffs. Well, at that point, by the way, almost all the closet ones were Republicans. The Democrats were out. And that he literally backed down because of that. He said –
Do you think he had internal caucus pressure to back down?
Yeah.
I bet. All right. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you correctly calculate in 93 that it won't effectively be repealed until Democrats control all three branches – or both chambers in the presidency. It was 2008 when you finally got the presidency in both chambers.
Well, January 2009. Remember, in 2009, the first thing out of the box is health care.
Yeah.
And it's complicated because the committee
thing after the Recovery Act, but yeah.
We are also trying to do Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And what happens is the House does pass it fairly easily because you're in the majority. So the House passes the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell fairly early in 2010, and we're on track. But it goes to the Senate, and this is a disappointment to me. The Republicans are still fighting it on the whole. And it cannot break the filibuster.
Who are the big voices fighting it?
John McCain, his eternal discredit. Yeah, Mr. Military. McCain was a major opponent of it. Other conservatives, but John.
Same arguments too, right?
Yeah,
morale of the troops.
Yeah. Don't put social progress ahead of
military
defense.
Yeah.
So McCain had been somewhat more supportive, but John. Remember, he had that Republican primary challenge back in, and he moved to the right.
So when he went down to the border wall and build a dang fence and all that. Yeah, okay.
In 2010 is the year he's up for re-election.
Tea party every year.
So they can't break the filibuster. So we have now – we included it. Here's the deal. We included – this is critical. We made the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell an amendment to the overall military authorization
the defense
bill for the year.
It
goes to the Senate, and it then becomes – The Senate, it bogs down in the Senate because the Republicans don't want to pass it with this in there. And then we lose the House.
Yes.
And when we lost the House, I panic because we say, okay, we go back and finish this next year. They're going to have to do a defense authorization. It is now clear to us as of November of 2010, the House has passed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and put in the authorization bill. The Senate hasn't passed the authorization bill. What we anticipate is that the Senate may now say to us, the Republican Senate, all right, we're going to separate them out. We can't pass them both. And we understand that if we don't get it done this year.
You will not get it done until you get the House back.
Right.
The Barney Frank rule that you need to have all the chambers.
You need the trifecta. Yeah. At that point, the Senate calls. I remember this. I was at a cataract. So I get very nervous. And in October, I remember the president was up. He was in Massachusetts. And I started telling everybody, the president, Harry Reid, Nancy, everybody I could talk to, people in the White House, we now have better get this done this year. This is by October. We're beginning.
So even before the election, you think the House might be lost.
And we worried about it. We got to be ready to do this in the lame duck. Steny Hoyer calls me towards the end of the session after in the lame duck. I remember this. I'd had a cataract operation. Jim, my husband, had come and was not yet then my husband, but we were living together, obviously. And he drives me back to my apartment here in D.C. And he said, by the way, as I get less groggy, Steny Hoyer wants you to call about gays in the military. So I call him. And he said, well, the Senate called me. And here's what they want us to do. They can't pass the defense bill with DADT in it. They want us to separate it and send it to them as two separate bills. And Nancy Pelosi calls, too. And I'm still getting focused. And Nancy said, no, we're not going to do that.
And the reason you don't do that is because you give up your entire leverage.
They'll pass one and not the other.
Yes. And they need to pass this because you have to fund the military.
Yeah.
No one wants to go home saying, we forgot to fund the military.
And there's a lot of ego in there because they get their policies in there. And so it's very important to the Senate, including the Senate Republicans. McCain's the senior Republican on this. By now, we got only a week to go. Here's what we're going to work out. We will pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell as a separate bill. We will send that to the Senate. The day the Senate passes Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal,
as a standalone,
we will then send them the authorization bill.
So essentially, you got to guarantee, Senate, you have to guarantee that you can pass Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
But we're holding.
We'll hold this whole thing hostage.
As a hostage. We're going to hold the defense authorization bill hostage. And I don't think they may believe this. Said day down in the well of the House, a wonderful man named Mike Skelton, who was a conservative Democrat in Missouri, who was going along with this, lost his seat in that year. He had already lost his seat. 2010 was a terrible year. And he had put a lot into the authorization bill. And he was worried the whole thing was going to go down. And we had this emotional scene in the well of the House in which I'd been empowered by Nancy to say, by the way, it made it a little easy because here's where my being open was helpful. Military authorization people would go to Nancy Pelosi. You're the Speaker of the whole House. You can't just cater to the San Francisco crowd. You got to go through. And, you know, it's always easier in a tough situation. You can blame somebody else. Not blame, but Nancy said, well, no, even if you persuaded me, Barney's going to go berserk and you're going to have, you know, all kinds of problems. So,
You send it to the Senate and then.
I was glad to. So yeah. What happens then is we send them Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Easily done.
Yeah. Oh, wait, sorry, I interrupted the Ike Skelton. So Ike Skelton, so he's – what was the emotional scene?
Well, on the floor because he wanted us to send the defense bill.
He was worried the thing was going to just implode.
Yeah.
And this was going to be his last act in Congress.
Something he put a lot of effort into. And I hated to do this to him, but it was, you know, beyond personal.
Okay.
Anyway, we send them Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and we're waiting for them to pass the to pass it, and then we'll send them the authorization. And maybe they thought we were bluffing, but I do remember this – you know, it's getting tense now. This is the last week. We're going to adjourn on Saturday, the senators. Nancy says to me, I think it was on Thursday, okay, we may be getting somewhere. Harry called me, Harry Reid, or maybe it was Wednesday, and he asked me when they were getting the defense authorization bill. And I said, she said, I told him, Harry, you'll get it as soon as you pass the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. He said, wait a minute. He put it on hold. And he came back a couple of minutes later and he said, all right, I just filed the cloture petition, which meant he didn't do it, but he was now committed to having a cloture vote.
Now the setting here is the Democrats have 59.
Yeah.
Okay. So they need to gain at least – the Scott Brown one, they need to gain one Republican, although they might lose some Democrats.
There was a fear that they could lose a
Democratic, too.
I'm trying to remember. Bob Byrd.
Was it Baucus?
No, Baucus was fine on this. Bobby Byrd had always been somewhat homophobic. Very homophobic.
He might have been gone by
he
that
He might have
point.
Been gone by then. But there was some fear. They
Nelson
sure.
of Nebraska, maybe? I remember there was a fear that they would need a couple Republicans.
Yep. So, and on the other hand, fairness, Susan Collins had come out strongly for this along with Joe Lieberman, and they were talking about doing it. So we knew we would have some, but we weren't sure. And the other issue then came here. McCain, again to his discredit, joined by Lindsey Graham, and I was very disappointed in Lindsey on this. The other thing that had to be done in the lame duck was the Senate ratification of this new nuclear treaty with Russia, which turned out to be wasteful and useless and mean nothing because we're not having to deal with Putin. And the,
at the time, it seemed like a very big deal.
Not to me. I thought it was big crap. And it was,
non-proliferation people
love it. Well, especially because John Kyle extorted from the administration a promise to spend another $8 billion upgrading our weapon system.
Yes.
Which was just
counterintuitive,
pissed away.
Yeah.
At any rate, what McCain and Graham said, they kind of tried to hedge it. They said to the Obama administration and to John Kerry, if you grab with this, we're going to walk away. If you push don't ask, don't tell through, we're going to walk away from this.
Start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the administration, we weren't sure they were going to say no. And I did go into my ballistic mode and threatened to denounce everybody. And Nancy was also, I couldn't have done it without the speaker's protection. So what happens is Harry tells Nancy, it sounds like the movie, Reed tells Pelosi, I filed the discharge petition. At that point, we knew. Well, we couldn't, if they couldn't get the votes, we couldn't complain. They made it.
Just had to get there.
But she and I talked and we said, okay, we'll take that as good faith. So at that point, we brought up the military bill.
Okay.
And the military bill, what's striking, people go back and look at this. I talk about it in my book. The Republicans who always voted for the military bill, a majority of them opposed it that time because they knew it was part of the deal to make Don't Ask, Don't Tell go through. And I said on the floor, okay, here's – and so then Nancy said, okay, but you guys got to help us pass the military bill. And Nancy later said, this is a historic vote. Why? Because you get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? No, because – Maxine Waters and Barbara Lee and Barney Frank all voted for the military bill. I on the phone, I say literally said, okay, let me tell you what I think about this bill. And I held my nose and held up my thumb. the bill passed and went over to the Senate.
Sure.
On that. So we did pass it.
So you got the military bill passed. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal bill, it was 3 pages or something. It was very small.
It says repealed.
Yeah. It was, and it passed. If I remember correctly, it passed
four or five votes. Yeah. To spare. And we got more Republicans.
It wasn't a squeaker. It was squeaker-ish, but it wasn't that close.
The tragedy was it was in competition on Republican votes for the Dream Act.
Yeah, was such a crazy lame duck session. There was so much going on.
The Dream Act lost,
and that was the one. Dream Act was the one thing.
Were some Republicans that would vote for one and not the other. You can only go off so many times. You have a certain. You have this, account. I can only piss off my voters on so many times and so many issues. Two, voting for culture on two very left issues.
Too much.
Basically, like thinking, hey, can I break with my party and vote for culture, which is an overwhelmingly radical thing to do, on fags and wetbacks in the same day? And the answer was some of them said, no, I can't do that.
All right. So 17 years after this first arises, it's repealed. And what I find remarkable about it, and you might have a different take on it, is just how non-controversial.
No, that's exactly that's my take. And that's been the take on everything. That's the secret of our success. It's the same
sky
with,
never fell.
With
morale never suffered.
It's the same with the Defense of Marriage Act. By the way, that's one reason why I felt so strongly that if all we could get was a bill banning discrimination in employment for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, even if we didn't get transgenders the first time, that was an important thing to do. Because in all of these pieces of legislation, the bigots are a small number. What we lose is they persuade other people who have no particular horse in the race that it will be socially disruptive. And the way we win is we go ahead and we do these things, and it is shown that there is no social disruption. And then you can move on from there. we weren't getting anywhere in marriage because of this fear that it would be so socially destabilizing until Margaret Marshall, God bless her, and the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court do it. We have it in Massachusetts. Within a couple of years, it's clear there's no impact. And both the marriage, it is hard for people to remember that both marriage and our serving in the military were once seen as destabilizing two very popular institutions. And at this point, most straight people have forgotten that they ever happened.
That was former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. Candidate Confessional is produced and edited by Zach Young, the maestro behind the theme music of the show as well. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and spread the word as usual to everyone that you meet randomly on the street. Next week on the show, Jason's back, and we sit down with two insiders in the 2008 push to pass the Troubled Asset Relief Program, otherwise known as TARP. It's a program that probably prevented a second Great Depression. See you then.